When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Genevieve Kosky
and Keith Phipps.
On last week's episode, we discussed In Cold Blood, the 1967 adaptation of Truman Capote's classic true crime book about the Clutter family murders of 1959 and the two ex-cons responsible for killing them. One of the essential pieces of that crime is how senseless and inexplicable it was. Why did four people get murdered in cold blood during what was intended to be a simple robbery? That question of why also hovered over the 2016 trial of Fabienne Caboo, a Senegalese woman who admitted to killing her 16-month-old child by leaving her on a beach and letting the tide sweep her out to sea. Director Alice Jopp, a documentary filmmaker, attended Caboo's trial and became obsessed with the case, not least because she is also of Senegalese descent and was curious about Caboo, particularly her difficult relationship to her mother. That experience sowed the seeds for Sant Omer, in which Jopp's on-screen surrogate is Rama, a literature professor and novelist played by Kaije Kagame. Working on a new book about the Medea myth, the pregnant Rama heads north from Paris to the city of Sant Omer to observe the trial of Laurence Colli, played by Guslaji Malanga. From the stand, Colli takes questions from the judge and the lawyers about her state of mind that day, and her thoughtful responses on her feelings of isolation within France and among those presumably closest to her have a powerful impact on Rama, and presumably those of us watching Jopp's film. We'll talk about it after the break.
C'était l'heure des hautes marées. La lune se dresse devant moi. Un projecteur, comme un appel de phare. Alors j'allais sur la plage.
Madame Colli, savez-vous pourquoi vous avez tué votre fille?
Je ne le sais pas. J'espère que ce procès pourra me l'apprendre.
Et toi, Rama? Ça avance, ton nouveau roman?
Bonne mine.
J'ai grandi avec ma mère. Nous sommes très différentes. Moi, je rêvais d'être une grande philosophe. On m'a freinée dans mon élan.
Okay, so basic first question about our new film. What did you think of Sant Omer?
It's films like this, and pairings like this, for that matter, that make me really grateful for the word compelling. because like, I can't say I liked this film, or I enjoyed this film, you know, but I couldn't look away from this film either, you know, but it's a difficult one. And it's difficult for a variety of reasons. And I think it, especially in its final argument, if you will, I found very unsettling while, you know, not being a mother myself, just like kind of the what it says about the perils of motherhood, I found, you know, kind of chilling and like left me, you know, kind of upset at the end of this film. That said, you know, it's a very well-executed film. Both of these actresses are, you know, the camera lingers on them, and for good reason. They, you know, do a lot with their faces, particularly Rama, who has, you know, very few lines. She's a taciturn character by design, and we feel with her very strongly.
Heath, what did you think? I have a sense you liked it because you reviewed it for the reveal, but what are your thoughts?
And yeah, I liked it a lot and ended up my top 10 list for the year. I was really kind of gripped by it, I guess. Compelled one you might even say, by the film. I thought that the choices Jop makes are really kind of like, not to get into comparisons ahead of time, but I think, you know, you present the facts of this thing, of this horrible crime, but like the humanity around it no matter how starkly presented, you cannot keep the humanity from leaking out. That's kind of an ugly metaphor, but you know, there's, you know, the trial is designed to, you know, we lay out what happened and why, and the why of it gets really complicated and ugly and in ways that I don't think you would necessarily expect given the facts of the case. And, you know, Rava is, her lines are few, and she seems like a fairly character who is not particularly outgoing person, who doesn't speak that much. Become more of an observer than a participant in the other aspects of her life as well. But her, you know, the subtle differences that Kagami, as you say, brings to her facial expressions while taking this, you know, in, and just sort of the way she changes over the course of the film, and when she kind of melts down in that one scene, it doesn't overdo anything, and I think by not overdoing it makes such moments all that more effective. I was really struck by this film.
Striking, another good word.
Yeah, striking. You're not going to say you had a rollicking good time watching this movie. That's what kind of sicko would feel that way?
I mean, but it's not Megan.
It's true. It's true. We enjoyed ourselves so much with Megan, we had to swing the pendulum back the other way this week.
So I struggled a little bit with this one, believe it or not. And I've been trying to sort out why. I feel like I have a reaction to the film that is more intellectual than emotional, which is surprising to me because this is such a, this act is the act of which that is committed here that is so shocking and such a repudiation of you know what you would expect, you know, for a mother to do, and you would think that the forces that would drive her to make this decision, all of the context surrounding this decision, would have just a sledgehammer emotional impact, and I didn't feel it, which I felt like the film was much more to me for affecting with the head rather than the heart, which is to me kind of a fault of the film, because it's trying to, because I think you are supposed to have, you know, a more emotional response to it than you get. The other thing too is I don't know about the character of Rama as a device for this movie, to have a character who I mean, the actress is so striking who plays her, and both actresses are so, have these very striking faces, and to see those reaction shots, I mean, you get the most you can possibly get from those reaction shots, but it's not a device I found particularly cinematic, and it's something I've seen in other movies before where a main character is reduced strictly to, you know, an observer for the most part, and it so rarely works for me, and it kind of didn't here either.
So it did for me, because I feel like the early scenes where we learn about her life, we learned a few details about her long, difficult relationship with her mother, the fact that she is with a white partner, like all these like sort of parallels that that'll be set up later. And then like they go uncommented upon, but I think they're in the back of our mind, just as they're in the back of Rama's mind as she watches the trial. For me, it worked, and it is definitely at a remove. I mean, Jop is a documentarian before this. I think she's bringing some of the same storytelling impulses to this narrative film as well. But I do think that character, you know, the character is somewhat distant, but I think that worked for me, and it apparently, you know, didn't work for you.
No, I mean, maybe not as well. I mean, it felt a very, all that backstory too feels a little bit packaged in a way for
a little. I can see that, the fact that we can just, you know, it does check a lot of boxes.
Yeah, I mean, these are more minor complaints than, not minor, but they're you know, there's a lot of about the film that I liked. I just kind of wanted to get my reservations out there first.
I think I share those reservations a little more with the sort of the first two-thirds of the film, but I think I think this movie, for me anyway, like it drives the emotion home. It waits to the end to drive the emotion home. I already mentioned that sort of the closing argument that Lawrence's attorney or counselor, I don't know anything about the French legal system, so.
Yeah, that was fascinating.
No, yeah. Right.
Yeah. But that she is like, yes, it is very written, you know, and it is very like sort of underlining these, but it got me like, just like the notion of it very, very much got to me. And then combined with what Keith already mentioned, Rama's sort of, you know, breakdown, sobbing, because most of the movie is just, I mean, it is an intellectual exercise. It's a trial, you know, I find it almost amusing that this movie begins with a pretty long sequence of the judge laying out the facts of the case and like just telling us everything that happened. And that is like the conceit of the movie, but it does sort of like place you as an observer, you know, someone observing this rather than feeling it, like kind of is starting the story that way. At least Lawrence's story. We have already spent some time with Rama at that point. But yeah, I don't know. The end of this film really worked for me, but I can very much understand it feeling kind of heavy-handed or tortured.
Yeah, I think I was also left cold by the speech mm-hmm. by the lawyer there, just because it just felt like too flagrant a violation of things long-held dramatic values. I mean, to be able to basically give what is more or less the film's thesis directly to the camera, to us, to speak to us in that way is just not the subtlest thing.
But I don't think it's trying for subtlety. I think that's the point. She's staring us directly in the face. And I think that is what is, and I will say like that is the one part in the movie where we see other women in the courtroom that we haven't seen before. You know, the camera actually starts roving to other women's faces as well. So I think that is like very much a like speaking directly to women moment. At least that's how I experienced it.
It is not surprising to learn that Jop does come from that nonfiction background, because there is a directness to this movie that is unusual, and a lot of it is beneficial. I mean, I think it ends up being, you know, a simple but extremely strong choice cinematically to really show us so many long unbroken passages of testimony. You know, that is very unusual for a movie to do. Feels like some like a direct cinema thing you'd see somebody like, you know, Frederick Wiseman pull off, but it's put in the context of a fiction film and it works great. And the actresses are, again, so Guzlaji Malanga is so, I mean, what a presence she has, and so to be able to kind of focus on her and the things that she's saying, and to access that testimony as directly as we do, ends up being a very powerful and persuasive cinematic choice, a directorial choice that maybe somebody who doesn't come from a nonfiction background might not have made.
I also was just very fascinated by sort of the mechanics of this courtroom. Again, not, you know, knowing any nuance of the French legal system and how it differs from ours. Like it was like watching a funhouse mirror version of an American courtroom drama. You know, like it had a lot of the same beats, but they were all a little different. You know, like jury selection, like that's how that works there. Or, you know, like cross examination is a whole different thing. The judge wears a red robe. I definitely like a couple of times felt the itch to like Google, you know, French courtroom custom stuff, but I did not, nor do I like think it would have added anything to the film. But I think sort of as a viewing experience for me, that was sort of an added element of interest here.
It gives so much power. It seems, again, from American eyes, to give so much power to the judge. I mean, the judge is also ends up being the asking most of the questions, and the other attorneys, I mean, they come in from, you know, different angles, sharper angles. They're, you know, angles of, you know, that you would expect from a prosecuting attorney, a defense attorney in the U.S. But a lot of, you know, everything is sort of driven by questions from the bench, and That was fascinating to watch. So I'm just now thinking about our if we have French listeners being just like, come on, man. Do we really have to hear about, you know, these idiots talk about
our
court system?
But the judge's robe is red. That's so weird, right?
Yeah, right. Right.
Did you know actually in France they don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese? All right, they're gone, sorry.
But it did draw out. I mean, the questions did feel from the judge anyway. It felt like they were evoking a defense or at least an explanation.
I kept feeling like sympathy coming from the judge. Or I kept feeling a desire for Lawrence to explain herself. I mean, obviously that's
curious.
What we want. Yeah. And I think she does come to this with a certain amount of sympathy, especially compared to, say, the prosecuting attorney who, you know, has a couple real dickish moments, you know, I guess as is his right as the prosecuting attorney of someone who has, you know, more or less confessed to murder already. But, yeah. You know, there are some like very awkward moments of testimony to like the philosophy instructor talking about why would she want to study a philosopher outside of her own culture, you know, or the very sympathetic, understanding white male law enforcement officer who, you know, really wanted to contextualize what happened in terms of her Senegalese identity and invokes female genital mutilation. Like, there's just these sort of, you know, they go uncommented upon, but you can kind of see, you know, flickers go across Lawrence's face and Rama's for that matter, that, you know, suggests they maybe cut a little more than they were intended to.
Yeah, absolutely. I cringed at that Wittgenstein moment too. How can someone from Africa ever understand European philosophy? Yeah, yeah. It's that kind of stuff. And there's not even that. I don't want to say there's that much of it because it's sort of pervasive, but it's like there's only a few moments that are that pointed. But when they do arrive, they're really pointed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I seem to remember some bit about her not being a very good writer, but being somebody who presents herself very intelligently in class and then can't write very well or something like that. As far as the sort of the dickishness, I guess, of the prosecution is that, I think his job in that situation is to say, hey, let's, you know, we're asking a lot of questions now about why she did this, but let's not forget what it is that she did.
Yeah.
And I think that's useful. I mean, that's useful from a strategic standpoint. I think it's also useful for us as viewers to not minimize this action that is shocking. And it's something we don't see. I think we get a little bit of an artful glimpse of it at the beginning where she's preparing to do what she ends up doing. But that is a pretty, you know, shocking thing to do to your child. So I think it is important for the movie in some way to kind of keep that in our minds as well before kind of trying to kind of let the context of what happened, you know, blot that out or mute that to any extent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually kind of really important to have that prosecuting attorney there in that sort of antagonist role because Rama is such a sympathetic point of view character here, I guess. We've already established like the many links between her and Lawrence, and, you know, she is like very clearly processing everything that's happening like through those similarities and, you know, her own pregnancy and impending motherhood and all the fear it brings with it. So I think because of that, it is very easy to sort of quote unquote side with Lawrence, or just like it was very easy for me to sort of understand what drove her to this, even as she was like very obfuscating and expressing herself. You know, it did, maybe it's just something about like Rama's face staring at her. I felt like it, you know, was urging us to just sympathize with her. So having these bursts of, you know, the prosecuting attorney or Luke's testimony kind of complicating that feeling and giving a different reaction was really important for the balance of that.
I mean, the parallels between the two women are so striking. I mean, the roots, their relationship to their mother, their
being academics.
They're both, right, exactly. They're both, and ambitious, both academics, and you know, and they're both, you know, one is a mother to be, and so I mean, the parallels are so strong that I mean, how could she not? How could Rama not think about paths that her life could have taken had things gone a different way? And how could she not think about her own sense of dislocation from, you know, the rest of, you know, French society, or in from Africa as well? I mean, you know, you get a sense of these two women being kind of stranded in terms of their identities, of not really feeling like they belong anywhere. And it just ends up being a much more powerful and ultimately destructive feeling for Lawrence, but they both feel it.
And I think it's notable that, like, right from the very beginning, we established that Rama is not necessarily comfortable with her pregnancy. Like, there's that moment at the family dinner where her husband, you know, says they're making some big changes to the house. Clearly a prompt to share some news, which she does not share. And he seems to understand why not. But there is definitely a reaction to that. So even before it is confirmed for us that Rama is pregnant, it establishes that it is not necessarily over the moon about it, which of course would color her reaction to what Lawrence did even more.
Yeah, I have to kind of almost go back to that performance. I've been thinking about that performance because I talked at the jump about my discomfort or dislike of using that character as kind of a dramatic device. I don't typically like it in movies, and I'm not necessarily persuaded by it here, but that actress is so compelling. Like, that, what a face. And like, mm-hmm. like, just, you know, there's so much that, you know, it's so hard to express yourself on screen when you have nothing to say, when it's all in your reaction. To have a performance that's so heavily reliant on reaction shots and still project or suggest to some degree what you might be thinking, that's really hard to do. And it's a really amazing piece of casting and a really good performance, I think, in its way.
Yeah, it would definitely, I mean, you know, it's kind of a pat thing to say, but it definitely would not be the same film with different performances. I don't think I'd seen either of these leads before, and I definitely will be on lookout for them in the future.
Yeah, there's no way, there's no link, if you go on like Wikipedia, where they don't have Wikipedia pages, these actresses. maybe we'll see more from them later, but there's a lot of striking performances in Cold Blood as well, and a lot of connections that we can make between Saint-Omer and In Cold Blood, and so we're going to go ahead and do that after the break.
Les images que vous venez de voir, dont j'ai choisi de lier la violence directe, l'historicité frontale au récit de la femme tendue que Duras invente dans Hiroshima, mon amour, nous montrent comment l'auteur a su transmuer le choc et le sentiment de révolte éprouvé devant ces scènes, par ailleurs banales au moment de l'épuration, en un chant presque lyrique.
Now it's time for connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. Well, one thing is that they're both true crime stories. Keith?
Yeah, I think that's the most obvious one, is these are both based on fact. Saint-Omer is more more fictionalized. I mean, we can get into the ethics of In Cold Blood, but it's definitely not purporting to tell exactly the same story, however much the details might square up. But these are both cases, like, you know, I had not heard of the story at the heart of Saint-Omer before, but it was a, you know, Googling a little bit, it was certainly a big story in France and other parts of Europe. So, you know, places that, these are cases that some of the audience at least would be familiar with. And I we're talking about films, you know, if In Cold Blood is sort of the big bang for true crime, this is something that's taking place at the other end of it. It's the most recent version of it. So I think it might be worth talking about how it is or is not part of that genre that we now call true crime.
Yeah, it's very unconventional, which is not to say that In Cold Blood itself is conventional. I think it has its own distinctions. It has thing. It has elements that other films of its kind would carry over, certainly. But there's a lot of complexity to its structure. There's a lot of complexity to its mix of docudrama and more expressive film noir qualities. It is bringing a lot of things to this genre that are unusual, but certainly not in the way that Saint-Omer does. Saint-Omer is striking in a whole lot of different ways. If you want to talk about in terms of true crime, it is not showing us the crime. It is a courtroom drama, but it is kind of extreme in that respect, in that it is very procedurally oriented. It's very oriented towards the testimony. It is taking place almost entirely or heavily in this courtroom, with a lot of scenes of unbroken testimony and process and things like that. I mean, again, these are not things that we think about when we think about true crime at all. And I think the other thing is that in both cases, the question being explored is why. It's not that the details of the crime necessarily, though both films get into those a little bit. It's really about trying to kind of sort out the case and sort out something, cases that are unusual, and trying to get at something psychological and not. And that's a little different too. But what do you think? What do you think, Genevieve? How they function? I can't even think about Saint-Omer as true crime, and yet I guess it technically is.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I think is interesting about these two films in tandem is how soon they came out after the crimes on which they are based. Both of them came out within under a decade of their sort of the events that inspired them. And that, like, I think it just creates a context where viewers, I mean, obviously we are not watching this in 1967, but viewers in 1967 certainly knew the story of In Cold Blood. And Keith, you said that the story that inspired Saint-Omer was well known in France. So, I think it positions the story from a place of, we know who did the crime. We know they're guilty. It's the question of guilt is not the story that's being told here. It's the why. It's the psychological element, as you said, Scott. So that is that's often the case with true crime, where it's sort of, we know the killer, we know what happened going in, and it's, more about understanding the details that led to that moment. I think that is also maybe where some of the squickiness around true crime sort of mythologizing of criminals maybe comes into play. I don't think that's necessarily a problem with either of these films, but I think, when you are coming at a story from a place of acknowledging that this person that committed this horrible crime, then being asked to understand them and sympathize with them is, it's a different sort of alignment with our, quote unquote protagonists than we're necessarily used to with other genres.
Yeah, and that kind of gets us to another connection, which is the commitment that both films have to understanding madness, because we do start at a point where the audience is completely familiar with these cases. These are cases where well covered, and this is something that Capote was able to get at with In Cold Blood, is that he had, one of the things he had sort of as an exclusive is access to the killers, particularly Perry. And he's able to try to answer questions that the facts alone can't tell us about his mindset, about how this robbery resulted in the deaths of four people who were cooperating and unarmed. So you get the insight there. And then of course Saint-Omer is really all about understanding Lawrence, but that's kind of what the courtroom proceeding is doing. It's just like, how could this happen? What were you thinking? What led up to this? What were you thinking at the moment? And then the question then becomes in both films, and then also of Capote's book is is it okay for us to sympathize? If we understand this madness, if we understand where they're coming from, if we can sympathize with their aspects of their past and present that may have you know, disturb them psychologically. Is that okay to feel that way, to be able to sympathize with people who have committed such awful acts? And I think both films are responsible with that question, but I don't know, maybe not. What do you all think?
I find it kind of amusing that Saint Omer kind of literally mythologizes the madness or the crime. You know, Rama is writing a book about the Medea myth, and at one point watches a YouTube video of a Medea film. Did either of you know what that film was, by the way?
No, I didn't recognize it.
Okay, but and then at the end, the chimera is brought into it as well. So there's sort of these, you know, very established mythological tropes through which we are viewing this character's sort of unraveling, which I thought was interesting just in terms of the idea that, you know, these criminals are being mythologized.
I thought in Saint Omer, though, it's kind of like the opposite of that, where I think she brought right. The Medea story into this and realized it didn't fit.
Yeah, totally. I don't know if Al's job was doing that like purposefully as a sort of like tweaking of understanding of true crime, how the true crime genre treats criminals, but mm-hmm. it certainly played to me as sort of a flipping of that.
Tyler Perry did that as well with Medea. Well, no, that's not right. Different Medea. Yeah.
And to link it back to in Cold Blood and sort of understanding the madness of these characters, both of these films tie very strongly to sort of their childhood and their parents and their parental relationships. They do so via flashback, and there's sort of a very strong correlation drawn between childhood trauma and sort of inflicting trauma or violence as an adult.
For sure, yeah. And again, it's kind of about accounting for the crimes rather than explaining them away, you know? Yeah, but I was curious to ask you all about, if you're talking about understanding madness and about explanations for this crime, about the sorcery angle of this in Saint Omer.
Well, I mean, I think you can't really ask that question without understanding the culture from which she comes.
But, yeah.
No, I'm being a little glib there because, like, maybe that is a factor, but just like the way it is presented.
I'm not insulted. It's fine. But it is something. It is an explanation. It is, and it really removes her from the equation. Yeah. It removes responsibility mm-hmm. from the equation.
Yeah, I think it's just a lot of part of the pattern of the film is presenting these explanations that don't explain that.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, it's I think at one point she says there's no explaining this, and then the film proceeds to prove her right, because there's that, there is the, you know, kind of being a kept woman of this artist, and, you know, not being allowed to interact with his family, and, you know, there is that, and it certainly seems to be true, but also he's the one who took care of the kid. It's all very, there's all these kind of contradictions in every single element of the story.
The clairvoyant with no phone records, that was very. You know, I like that about, you know, this is a film about failing to explain the unexplainable.
Mm-hmm. There is, like, you know, madness is an explanation and probably the best explanation, but I mean, what is madness, I guess, is a whole other question, but Laurence is so composed. I guess she breaks down, but she's also, you know, not someone who seems, who, if you just talk to her for a moment, would seem unstable, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of true of Perry as well. I mean, it's certainly true of Dick in Cold Blood, but, you know, Perry is, I mean, he can definitely be a menacing figure. Again, that sort of, that opening scene. But, you know, he's another sort of just like taciturn figure. His madness isn't loud. You know, it's very internal. The only reason we are aware of it is through these sort of flashback devices. And, you know, we kind of see the effect it has on him through some, you know, acting choices, but it's not explicated in the dialogue in any way that this is going on inside of him.
Yeah. There's a interesting sensitivity to him, a vulnerability to him, and to Laurence, and obviously in Saint Omer, you know. But, and of course, there's this idea of this incident being a moment of temporary insanity, at mm-hmm. least in the case of In Cold Blood, of just like of Perry being like this ticking time bomb, or being this situation being put in the situation that he was psychologically not prepared to handle, and in you know, this explosion that was almost you know, bound to happen, you know, something when things went the way they did. It's a little different, I think, in Saint Omer, just because there was a certain amount of planning involved, I guess. You know, it didn't feel like it didn't seem as much like a spontaneous act. Or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, because I mean, she had to travel to do it, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just the, you think about the time that she spent to get there, the her plan of getting away, you know. I mean, there was this thought of getting away with it, you know, and also wanting to do this. I mean, what Perry and Dick want to do is get money.
Yeah.
I mean, that was what they wanted to do. That's not what ended up happening.
It's sort of the opposite ends of the spectrum as far as between Perry and Lawrence, you know, like the quote unquote temporary insanity. And Lawrence, like, you know, we're given to understand, like, she was in a dark, dark place even before she got pregnant, you know, or at least as she puts it. And, you know, it kind of feels like this act was the culmination of a long, drawn out descent rather than an explosive act.
Yeah, that's probably true. One connection, I guess, or point of departure between the two that I think is worth talking about is the structure, because, you know, we had talked a lot about the structure of In Cold Blood and in the placement of the murders towards the end of the movie, and the flashbacks, and then also some of the nature of those flashbacks, you know, within flash. I mean, there's a lot of interesting work with time. The structure of Saint Omer is intriguing too, you know, because you do get this, a portion of the film where it begins, where you're getting to know Rama and getting some context for her life before you get to Saint Omer. And then you have something that is a movie that is actually quite strikingly straightforward in terms of just you're in this courtroom, you're seeing these proceedings, you're hearing, you know, a courtroom proceeding as it might actually unfold, or at least some portion of a courtroom proceeding as actually might unfold.
Yeah, but there are some, I think, really important digressions within that straightforwardness. Like, there are several flashbacks to Rama's childhood at you know, notable points as they relate to the testimony unfolding. And there's also the scenes with Lawrence's mother, which I found, I actually don't know. Did you find those scenes additive at all?
I think they shed some light on where Lawrence comes from. I found them memorable. Mm-hmm. Certainly the lunch scene and the way she kind of is proud of her daughter for being in the newspaper.
Yeah. That was really such a interesting.
It's a disturbing detail that kind of, but also like, it's another character that I don't know that she's easy to explain at all either.
Which I think is, which given, I guess, Lawrence's feelings about her, I think it makes sense that depiction for sure.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that's one of the things that in Sonomare's favor is, I think that all of these characters that we do see and hear from Lawrence's life are so complicated and so interesting. I mean, the father of her child is a really interesting character. Her professor or whatever, that's a, you know, he's got an interesting perspective as well, as does her lawyer, as does the judge, as does the prosecutor, whatever the equivalent of a prosecuting attorney is. I mean, all of that, these characters have been pretty well thought through and have, you know, in kind of evoke a lot of different feelings. They're not really drawn in too stark a way. So before we finish connections, we have to have our closing argument about a connection between the films, which is the closing arguments. Genevieve?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned it in the first half, sort of how I found it unexpected that so little of In Cold Blood took place in the courtroom based on what my understanding of the film had been. And also sort of the short bit we get of the prosecuting attorney's closing argument, which is weirdly quoting from the Bible. like he had to read the "Thou shalt not kill," but the very long passage he knew by heart. I thought that was kind of funny.
It also seemed like something that you might have heard in more courtrooms at the time than you do now.
Yeah, that too. But also just contrasted with Saint Omer and the very either effective or overwritten closing argument, depending on your point of view. You know, mm-hmm. it is like a striking contrast. But, you know, they do both serve in a way to let the film make a bigger statement, I think, much more explicitly in Saint-Omer. But I don't know. Do you see any sort of big rhyme between the courtroom, what we get in the courtroom and In Cold Blood, and what the film is doing at large? Or is it kind of a separate thing?
Well, I almost feel like when I think about closing arguments in Cold Blood, I almost think about it metatextually. I think about it like, what is the argument the film is making? Mm-hmm. Where does it end its argument? Where does it end up? And that was something we got into a little bit about its feelings about the death penalty. There's so much invested in understanding how death row works and understanding how the process works of hanging a person and what can be expected from that process. We get a lot more from Perry and about his reflections on the past and his feelings. All of that kind of comes through, and that kind of that feels like a closing argument in and of itself. You know, it doesn't really have to do with a courtroom. It has to do with, you know, morality, and it has to do with
justice,
right? And the machinations of society and how we treat, you know, the people who've done the worst crimes, and what does that say about us as a society? That is all kind of reserved to the end, and then you're left with more death, not just the clutters who have died, but also these two men we've gotten to know who have their necks snapped and their hearts continue to beat and they defecate or whatever. Like, it's like that level of just like, you know, you're really just getting more death, and the film, I think, is making its own argument in that way.
And I think Saint-Omer does something kind of similar in its final scene, which is not that big lawyer speech, but months later, Rama with her mother, in silence, but holding hands, you know, and her, mm-hmm. I thought it was very interesting that the sort of final line of dialogue of the film was her mother just saying, "I'm tired," you know, and then that being the end, and sort of, I feel just as a punctuation mark on, you know, what the attorney was laying out as far as, you know, the potentially destructive symbiotic relationship between mother and child, and it sort of passing on through generations. It was just that was sort of the emotional button on that maybe more intellectually oriented closing argument.
Yeah, it's a kind of a lovely little sort of denouement. Mm-hmm. In Cold Blood, I was able to watch through TCM via Hulu Live or whatever, but you can't do that anymore. So In Cold Blood can be rented on the usual streaming services. You can also get it on DVD or Blu-ray from Criterion. Saint-Omer is currently in theaters. Finally, it's time to recommend a film or film-related item that complements this set of episodes. We call it Your Next Picture Show, in the hopes it'll put some interesting choices on your radar.
And Scott, you are the one who is going to put some interesting choices on our radar this time, correct?
Yes, thank you. For the reveal, I guess it would be a couple of weeks ago, I wrote a piece about the Neon box set. Neon is the distributor of Saint-Omer, kind of a ranking the Neon box, and the Neon box has become, I think, for critics, and I think you all will probably agree with this, kind of the most anticipated shipment of screener season, and they're such an interesting, you know, the other really interesting one is A24, and I think people know A24 because A24 has a little more money. They're extremely good at branding themselves. You almost have a sense of what an A24 film is, but the films that Neon has been able to distribute in the last several years have been pretty incredible. They did Parasite, they did Portrait of a Lady on Fire, they did The Worst Person in the World and Memoria, and now this year they've got Saint-Omer, and you know, I kind of wanted to go through. I mean, I saw all 12 films that were in the box that were put out this year. All 12 films were critically acclaimed, and I quite liked 11 out of the 12 of them. So it is, you know, a pretty formidable list. And a lot of them are coming to Criterion. My favorite film, one of my favorite films of the year is a neon film called All the Beauty and the Bloodshed. That's Laura Poitras' documentary about the photographer Nan Golden and her, you know, various connections in the New York art and activism scene. That's an incredible movie. They've got a couple of films that they put out this year that are going right to Criterion, including Saint-Omer. Also, Moon Age Daydream is going to Criterion. Triangle of Sadness is going to Criterion. They did the David Cronenberg movie, Crimes of the Future. And I guess one, you know, to kind of put a cap on this, the one film that people may not have seen or heard of that they should really keep an eye out for that Neon put out this year is called The Quiet Girl. I think maybe it's still in theater, so maybe people are just catching up to it. But it's this really beautiful, simple Irish drama about a 9-year-old girl who's very withdrawn and is part of this poor yet very rapidly expanding Irish family, who gets sent off to live in the country with her mother's distant relatives who have no children. And it's about the relationships she forms with them, the bond that she forms with them on a farm, and then of course the inevitable moment when she has to kind of return to a much less satisfying life at home. And it's such a gorgeous movie, and I think it's one of those things where you know, it's worth looking at the label sometimes. You know, that was my thing when I was getting into music. It was like, oh, Merge Records put this out, I need to listen to it, you know, because they have really good taste. And I think the level of curation, the diversity of selections that they have with Neon, I think it's kind of worth, you know, we know A24 is a brand. I think it's worth kind of getting to know Neon as a label and kind of seeing that and seeing it as potentially a mark of quality, because Saint-Omer is really the tip of a very large iceberg.
Plus, they got a cool logo. Kind of leaps out.
It does. So there you go. It feels weird recommending a company, but when you put out that much good work, it's kind of like, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'll recommend it.
Well, you mentioned The Quiet Girl, which I looked up while you were talking about it, and I don't know if it has it had an Oscar qualifying run in New York and LA at the end of 2022, but I don't see anything about a wider release yet.
So maybe it's something that's going to be coming up, yeah.
Yeah, but it is, Ireland's Oscar submission.
It's an Irish with subtitles.
Yeah, Irish language. Because
a lot of that language you do not understand.
It's an Irish. I mean, yes. It's actually in
Irish. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Understand any of it.
Not at all.
It's a totally different language.
Exactly. It's lovely. They did Petite Maman. That was also them. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is this year's Petite Maman for them in terms of, like, you know, like kind of where you're at on it emotionally. It's lovely. Lovely stuff.
Hope I get to see it. I'm sad I don't get the Neon box anymore.
I know. We got to get it on the Detroit. There's a Detroit.
Is there one?
I mean,
Midwest Film Critics Society online. You got to get on something.
There is a Detroit Film Critics Society. It has a Wikipedia entry that has over 20 members. I don't see why you shouldn't be a part of this, unless it's like lame. It could be lame. Let's see. Was their best film of? Let's see what their best film, most recent best film winner. They seem to only have back to 2021 on this Wikipedia page, but yeah. Oh, their best film was Cyrano.
Oh,
okay.
Interesting.
Yeah, that was last year. Best director, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Ooh.
Best actor, Peter Dinklage. Chastain.
Wait. What? Lin-Manuel Miranda for
Tick, Tick, Boom?
For Tick, Tick, Boom?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, hold on. Okay. Best supporting actor, John Bernthal. In the film King Richard. Yeah, okay. I was trying to think of some costume. Did I miss a costume driver called King Richard? Like, no, I understand.
Oh my gosh.
He was actually really good in that film too. So anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you got to get in there. You got to take it over.
Yeah, those are some pretty weird selections. That's it for this edition of The Next Picture Show, but we'll be back next week with a special episode that dips into television a little. Genevieve, do you want to tell us about our episodes dropping February 7th and 14th?
Sure. The new HBO series, The Last of Us, based on the popular video game franchise, tells the story of a dystopian future where a highly transmissible fungus is turning humans into what are essentially zombies. While the outbreak has spread around the world, a handful of survivors have remained human, but they're fighting on more than one front. There's also civil tension between the authoritarian government, Fedra, and a rebel faction known as the Fireflies, and our hero, played by Pedro Pascal, has his allegiances tested. Of particular interest is a 14-year-old girl named Ellie, played by Bella Ramsey, who is immune to the infection and thus highly valuable to all parties and perhaps the future of mankind. That aspect of the story calls to mind Alfonso Cuarón's 2006 sci-fi movie Children of Men, which is set in a dystopian England where the world is beset by mass infertility and the human species is headed toward extinction. The one glint of hope is a young woman who happens to be pregnant.
For now, we welcome your feedback on In Cold Blood, Saint Omer, and anything else film-related you'd like to talk about. Email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net or leave us a voicemail at 773-234-9730. Before we close out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days? Keith Phipps?
I'm a freelance writer. I'm on Twitter at kphipps3000 still somehow. And you can find my work at places like GQ, The Ringer, TV Guide, Vulture, and a place called The Review, which is a newsletter on Substack that I co-write with my friend and fellow podcast co-host Scott Tobias. It's thereveal.substack.com. We're watching all 100 of Sight and Sound's 100 best movies of all time. Not all at once, though. We're doing it slowly.
No, we're going to do it over a period of years.
Yes, yes. Jenna, how about you?
I am a TV editor at Vulture, where I edit many things, including recaps of The Last of Us, written by one Keith Phipps. So if you want to prepare for our next pairing, you might want to check that out. And I am on Twitter, sort of still doing stuff. I retweeted an article today at Genevieve Kosky. Scott?
Were you attacked by neo-Nazis when you did so?
No. I just retweeted something I edited, which is pretty much all I do on Twitter now.
Yeah. It's so weird to think about, like, yeah, I'm still there. I'm going to stay and fight. It's like, I didn't come to a fight. I just came here to just shoot the shit with my friends. Why has this become a nightmare? Anyway, you can find me on Twitter at Scott_Tobias. Yeah, I'm still, which has become, it reminds me of Usenet back when I first started being on the internet. You can find me at The Reveal with Keith, and you can find me in the New York Times and Vulture, Guardian, and other fine publications. You can find our absent co-host Tasha on Twitter at Tasha Robinson. She is also the film and streaming editor for Polygon.com. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod. Get bonus content and open discussion at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And as always, we appreciate your ratings and reviews on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. Thanks to Dan the Baked Jakes for his assistance producing this podcast. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts. Please tune in next time.